today we have an amazing privilege to visit with one of the greatest investors of all time. For the last 40 years, most people have called this man the dean of all investing. He's done it through a variety of approaches, but I think one of the major aspects of his success is his ability to look at the long term and to find optimism where other people saw pessimism. And that's something that's valuable not only in investing, but in our lives. And that person is not only one of the greatest investors, but I honestly believe one of the great human beings in the world. For the last 22 years, this man, Sir John Templeton, has also been responsible for giving more than $1 million every year to individuals or organizations that he thought made the biggest difference in improving understanding of religion and our relationship with our Creator. So this man is what I would call truly wealthy beyond money. And I feel so fortunate to be able to have a chance to visit with you today. Please welcome Sir John Templeton. Very good.
A pleasure to be with you and all of your friends.
Thank you, Sir John. So John, a lot of people are familiar with your background, and some people aren't. They just know the level of your success. They don't know the amount of education that you put into your life and the amount of risks that you've taken. Could you give us a little bit of background of how you first got involved in investing, what drew you to it, and how you started your first firm or purchased your first firm back in 1940?
Yes, Tony. I grew up in a small town in Tennessee where no one owned any shares. But when I got to be a sophomore at Yale, I found that it could be a great service to judge the values of corporations because their share prices went up and down every year far more than the value. So I undertook to become an appraiser of corporations and continued to major in economics at Yale and law at Oxford. And then my wife and I pledged ourselves to save 50 cents out of every dollar we earned and to invest it carefully. So 3 years later, when we had an opportunity to take over the small practice of a retiring investment counselor, we had the savings needed to do that. So we began, as any young professional does, with no clients in Radio City in New York, and worked there for 25 years, continuing to save 50 cents out of every dollar so that we could build up our assets for our retirement and for charity.
Well, that's an amazing result you've produced out of that 50 cents for every dollar. What has been the overall return so people understand? My understanding is that in 1954, if someone invested $10,000 with you and just forgot about it, by the 1980s it was worth something like $2.2 million, is that correct?
Yes, provided they reinvested their distributions. That's what it would amount to. And there were some people who did that. And now that I have sold all of those investment businesses, the people who are now running it were selected by me and trained by me. And I do hope they're going to produce in the future results something like we were able to produce in those past 40 years.
Pretty amazing results. When I was last with you a few years back, actually a couple of times, I was asking you about where in the world, your favorite phrase, to invest. Where in the world would you find the bargains? And I remember a couple things were happening at that time. You talked about emerging growth markets, and a lot of people were laughing. In fact, I think your first year, the returns were not very exciting. The press was on your case. But I understand this last year, the results of that is the emerging market fund brought back about a 97% return on the year, and I think the emerging growth fund was 76%, is that correct? And what creates those kinds of returns?
Yes, the organization, before I sold it, was the first in the world to offer to the public mutual fund shares that would invest in the emerging markets. Those small nations which had always been considered too risky for us to invest in before. And that was 6 years ago, and the performance has been truly outstanding. So from the original $100 million, other funds have been formed, managed by that organization, about $12 billion in these foreign emerging markets, and many other competitors, more than a dozen now, have similar funds. So that the Americans in general are investing something like $15 billion in the poor, small, emerging markets where it's difficult to get information, but where the potential is sometimes very great.
Why should we feel good about the investments that we do overseas as Americans? Some people would say, why invest overseas? It seems like that's taking away from America. You were one of the first people to go into emerging markets. You were one of the first people to go overseas and be an international investor. Why should investors want to go outside their own country to make investments today?
Yes, it has always seemed to be just common sense, Tony. Think about this. If our job is to find the best opportunities, surely we will find more opportunities if we do not limit ourselves to just any one nation. Likewise, perhaps we will find better opportunities if we are able to look everywhere rather than just one nation. But most important is it does reduce your risk, because every nation has bear markets. Usually about twice every 12 years, there's a severe bear market in a major nation, but they do not occur at the same time. So if you are diversified, having your assets in many nations, you do not have to suffer through the bear market in one nation as a person who had all of his eggs in one basket. So for those three reasons, we have always advised our investors to be diversified. Not only diversified into more than one corporation, diversified in more than one industry, but also diversified into more than one nation, in order that they will get greater safety and greater potential profit.
Fantastic. Let me ask you this. Also, I know you focus quite a bit on improving the quality of life. When we make investments in those types of nations, does it really affect the quality of life for us here back in the United States, do you think?
Yes, it does in both cases. The money that is earned by investing in those small nations means the dividends and interest come back to the United States for the investor. But at the same time, we help those nations to grow in prosperity, and they become customers for the exports from the United States. So they help the United States to be more prosperous by exporting more, in addition to which we get spiritual rewards for helping the people who were previously pitifully poor to catch up somewhat with the remarkable prosperity in America.
One of the things that I've always respected and loved about you as a human being is that many people, when they think about money or wealth, they think about something that is cutthroat. They think about something that doesn't take into account the human spirit. How do you resolve the break that so many people have between spirituality, if I may ask you, and finance? Do they go together?
Definitely. There is no disparity. There is no conflict. Again, using just common sense, would you want to deal with a businessman you could not trust? No. If a man has a reputation for not being trustworthy, people will run away from him. His business will fail. But if another man has high ethical principles, high spiritual principles, he will try to give to his customers and his employees more than they expect. If so, he will be popular. He will have more customers. He will make more profit. He will do more good in the world, and thereby he will prosper himself and have more friends and be more respected. So always start out to give more than you get, to give more than is expected from you, to treat the other person more than fairly, and that is the secret of success. Never try to take advantage of anyone or to hold anyone back in their own progress. The more you help others, the more prosperous you will be personally.
What is your definition of wealth, Sir John?
Well, the Bible says to store up your treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, nor thieves break through, nor steal. And if I had to choose one investment, Tony, the one that I've never seen to fail, it is tithing, T-I-T-H-I-N-G. giving 10% or more of your income to churches and charities. I have never met or watched anyone who did tithing for 10 years who did not become both prosperous and happy. The qualities it takes to be a good tither are the same qualities it takes to be a good businessman, to be popular, to be sought after by your customers.
Let me ask you, Sir John, over the last period of time, as you've done all this tithing, I know you helped start the college at Oxford. I know you give, again, $1 million a year away, which is higher than the Nobel Prize for people who really produce or promote spiritual principles. What do you think is the first road for someone being able to do that? So many people say, well, I'll tithe once I have some money. Why shouldn't someone wait? Why should they start now, even if they're in financial trouble with tithing?
Oh, they should. It's only an excuse to say that I will begin once I have more money. If I can put that in dramatic terms, Americans now save very little. They only save about 4 cents out of every dollar they earn because they say they can't save more. But in mainland China, where the national income is less than 1/20th of American income, those people save more than 1/3 of their total income. So it doesn't matter whether your income is small or large, you can be a tither and you can be a saver.
And you must be a saver to really become wealthy, because otherwise you have nothing to invest with. Let me ask you this, sir. What you believe has been the most important principle that has separated you from all the rest? What has made you, and I know you might not call yourself this, but the greatest investor of all time, or at least one of them? What do you think has separated you from the group?
Thank you. I do not regard myself as that.
I know you're very humble.
I just studying and working. I've been working nights and days and weekends trying to learn more in order to help the hundreds of thousands of people who invested in the Templeton Mutual Funds. We've not always been right. No one is. But we have tried to be a little better than the other competitors and to give more than is expected from us, and always to try to improve our methods, to use new methods in order to stay ahead of the competition. If there's any secret in it at all, it is this. Do not try to be a go-getter. Try to be a go-giver.
Very good. Your giving philosophy certainly has worked for billions of dollars for hundreds of thousands or millions of people. Let me ask you this. As you look at investing then, what would you say is the single biggest mistake that investors make? And what do you think is the single most important thing for them to do to avoid that mistake and become successful as investors?
Perhaps the greatest mistake is not to be thrifty. The great majority of people do not build up any wealth because they do not practice the self-discipline of saving some of their income every month to build up their wealth. But beyond that, once you've saved that money, then you have to invest it wisely in good bargains, and it's not easy. It's very, very rare for any one person, particularly any one person working in just their spare time, to select the right investments, any more than you would want to be your own medical doctor or your own lawyer. It's not wise to try to be your own investment manager. It's better to find the best professionals, the wisest security analysts, to help you. You can do that by hiring an investment counselor if you have enough assets, or if you have smaller assets, then to invest in those public investment mutual funds who then hire for you some good investment counselor in order to produce the better results in the long run.
I know that you teach, though, it sounds as if you would say give your money to a manager, which I think is accurate, but I think you also teach you've got to be responsible for your own money. You don't, just like a doctor, you want to just take one opinion and hope it's right. How do you balance that out? How do we take responsibility for how we're investing our wealth rather than just hoping that the person we've selected will do a good job?
As you said, it is very much like selecting a doctor or selecting a lawyer. You do need to study the person, his background, his history, his methods, and the organization that he has built. Talk with some of his customers, just as you would with a lawyer or a doctor. But in the field of investments, you do have one more advantage, is that every mutual fund is required by law to publish the results it has had in the past years. So you can very easily get a comparison of which mutual funds were most profitable in the past. And although that doesn't guarantee they will be the best in the future, it at least is one more help you have that you do not have when selecting professionals in other careers.
That makes sense. Let me ask you this. You talk constantly about the long term. Will you please address this for our students and the people listening in? What is the importance of long-term versus short-term investing? What is the difference between long-term and short-term investing as far as you're concerned?
The short-term prices are determined very heavily by human emotions, and that can go up or down unexpectedly. But in the long run, the price of the shares of a corporation will depend on the earnings of that corporation. So that value will prove to be the controlling influence in the long run. Or, to put it in a different way, all economic matters, especially the stock market, goes in cycles. There are bull markets and bear markets, and you never know when they're going to start or stop. But if you're a true long-term investor, you don't need to worry about that. You buy and hold the assets through two or three bull and bear markets, through two or three cycles. So the underlying strength, the underlying earning power will determine your profits.
So how
long?
I'm sorry.
Well, for example, we think there will be probably as many as six or seven bear markets in the next 40 years. But we also think that earning power of corporations may rise by fourfold in 40 years in today's dollars. Then, of course, we think the dollar will lose in value. So in terms of future dollars, the earnings will be even greater than that. So if you look long range, you're a true investor, not a speculator. It's easier to find the true bargains and take less risk.
I know, talking to some of your associates when I was down in the Bahamas at one point, I said, what does he invest in? What is his favorite thing to invest in? And they said, anything. He'll buy a tree if he knows. He'll buy anything that he knows is undervalued. And I said, how long will he hang on to it? And they said, forever. They said, he'll hang on to it until it's worth more. Can you explain that? How long will you hang on to an investment?
Well, Tony, this is a basic principle that applies in all of your activities, and that is that good fortune tends to come to the person who is prepared ahead of time. If you do hard work, study, common sense, mathematical comparisons, then when a bargain comes along, you will recognize it to be a bargain. Let me give you two quick illustrations that are way out of line with the investment world. But one day I was reading a little two-line advertisement in the New York Times that said, 500 acres of land for sale on paved highway within 100 miles of New York City, $17 an acre. I called up on the telephone and bought it that night on the telephone because I already knew enough about values to know that was exceptional and wouldn't last. It turned out to be Little Buck Mountain in Pennsylvania near Nuremberg, and my children still own that mountain. But one more quick one. When I was traveling in Rio de Janeiro, I went to see a jeweler who was offering my wife amethyst rings. And I said to him, what do these amethysts look like when you buy them from the discoverers, the explorers from the field? So he took me to his warehouse and showed me a room covered 2 feet deep with big crystals of amethyst. I said to him again, in this stage, what do these cost? He said, $2 a pound. So I bought 2,000 pounds of amethyst.
But the secret to investing right there from Sir John.
To be prepared.
Be prepared. How long will you hang on to an investment before you let it go? How do you know when you've made a mistake? How do you know when it's time to liquidate?
That is one of the most important questions. Many people will say, I know when to buy, but I don't know when to sell. But over these 54 years that I've been helping investors, I think I have the answer. That is, you sell an asset only when you think you have found a different asset that's a 50% better bargain. You search all the time for a bargain, and then you look at what you now own. If it's something in your present list that is 50% less good bargain than the one you found, you sell the old one and buy the new one. But even then, you're not right all the time.
That's true. How do you deal with the emotion of taking losses? You're such a responsible human being. I know you don't take anything lightly, especially other people's fortunes that you're managing. How do you deal with the emotion of that? What's your belief system about dealing with losses?
But in those years, those 53 years when I was truly active in investment counsel, before I retired and began to devote almost 100% of my time to church and charity work, in those years, I went to explain to every client that they must not expect us to be correct in our decisions more than two-thirds the time. The difficulty is so great that if we just made one mistake out of three decisions, the total result would be good. So we kept a record for years and years of what we bought and sold, and we showed when we were right, when we were wrong, but we also showed the long-term good result, which you already mentioned earlier in this program, and that showed them that they did not need to be upset, and we did not need to be upset, because we do make so many mistakes, because if we work hard, we will make more right decisions than wrong ones.
How do you think that relates to people's daily lives outside of finance?
Oh, very much so. I was asked on a television program recently why we do not form an investment mutual fund to invest just in every stock, in the stocks in the index, because that way we would always have an equal share of all the big companies. But I said to him, it's true that when we go to sell one stock and buy another, we are not right all the time. And if you look at everybody in the world, there are exactly as many people wrong as right. But that same thing would be true about the game of tennis. If throughout the history of that game, there have been exactly as many winners and losers, but that's no reason for the good tennis players to stop playing.
Touché. Very nice. Tell us about your very first decision to invest, if you would. What's the 53 years? How old are you, may I ask? I thought you were 80 years old.
I'm 81 years old, Tony. Almost middle age, I think.
Yes, I think you're right. And you certainly act less than middle age. What was your very first investment, I guess, 53 years ago? What made you decide to invest in that, and how did it turn out?
The first investment I bought was a preferred stock of Standard Gas and Electric, but I think it'll carry the message better. Is when I was just getting started, was the beginning of the Second World War in September 1939. Now, we had just finished the world's greatest depression, and there were many bankrupt companies, but a war causes a demand for almost every product. So during a war, almost every company will prosper again. So I gave a stockbroker an order to buy $100 worth of every stock on both exchanges, selling for $1 or less. And there were 104 of them. And out of those, I made a profit on 100, lost money on only 4, and here was the best of all. One of those stocks was a $7 preferred stock of Missouri Pacific Railway, sold in the 1920s, paying $7 cash per year, but the railway went into bankruptcy, and that preferred stock could be bought for 12 cents. So for my $100, I got 800 shares of that preferred stock. Then the war put the traffic on the railway and it began to prosper again. And that stock went up from 12 cents to $5. I thought I was so smart and sold out. And yet when 2 years later, it went up to 107.
Did you find a stock that you thought was a 50% better deal than the railway before you let go of that stock, or did you just try to cash in?
No, I followed the principle back then. They were at that time better bargains, yes.
Fantastic. Well, then it sounds like you did the right thing. Tell me, I remember when we sat together about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe it was longer, I've lost track of time. You know how it is at my age. But I do recall at the time I asked you, where in the world is the bargain right now? Where are you investing? And you said Hong Kong. And I said, Hong Kong? Everybody was fleeing from Hong Kong because they said, you know, China's going to take it over, the market's going to disappear. And you just smiled real big and said, yeah, but there's some great bargains there. There's some things they're going to need no matter what. Even if they do take over, there's some companies they're going to need. Tell us about that. Tell us two things. How do you find that bargain? Where do you look, and where in the world would you find it today, in your opinion?
Now, that's a very basic principle, Tony. You find the bargains at the point of maximum pessimism. From a time standpoint, you find it when people in general are pessimistic. That's the low point of the market. But if you're looking at a nation, you find it in the nation where there's great pessimism, or the industry where there's great pessimism. So there's nothing that will make the price of a share go down except the pressure of selling. So you can only get a bargain when other people are urgently selling. Now in Hong Kong, they were selling because they were frightened to become part of a communist nation. But thereby the share prices were so depressed that we were buying them at bargain prices, thinking that even after it becomes part of a former communist nation, it would still be the financial center, maybe the commercial center for over 1 billion people. So we did buy heavily in Hong Kong, and even just last year alone, the Hong Kong market went up over 100%. Now it's no longer a bargain. Now there are too many other people buying there, and it's not a point of maximum pessimism. But to complete the answer to that, where in the world are they today? In the world today, there are several markets that went up 100% last year when the American market was only going up 10%. Those were Hong Kong and Indonesia and Sri Lanka and Brazil and Finland and Turkey. All of those went up more than 100% in 1 year. But, on the other hand, there are many markets now that are still depressed, where people are still despondent, where share prices are 50% or more below their previous high. And they would be Greece and New Zealand and Turkey and Portugal. All of those are more than 50% down from their highs. So to finish your question, you buy at the point of maximum pessimism, and then you wait patiently until that pessimism is gone and the share price has gone up. Then you try to find a different place of maximum pessimism.
And if I can complete the answers, I think I've heard you share it with me before. You also sell, hopefully, at the high of optimism. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's a good saying there, Tony. Bear markets start on the time of pessimism. They rise on the time of skepticism. They mature on the time of optimism, and they end on the time of euphoria. That always happens in every bull market, and it helps you determine where you are. If you will just talk with enough investors to find their psychology, you can tell whether the market is still safe at a low level or high at a dangerous level.
Sir John, in the markets you described that went more than 100% last year, how does a person determine whether that there is still growth left in that market, whether there are still bargains or not?
Just as you said before, you do it by valuation. you take appraisals, just like a real estate appraiser would appraise a hotel. He would study the number of rooms, the price, what other hotels sold for, the profits, and so forth, and come out with a reasonable estimate of the value of that hotel. So does a security analyst appraise a corporation. So we appraise the corporations and then compare the market prices to the estimated value. Now, it's true that a market can easily go up 100% and still be a good value. And whether it is or not depends on comparing the price with the value.
That makes sense. Peter Lynch, who we have a chance to visit with here at Master University as well, is an amazing trader. And one of his philosophies is he tells me that he believes that anyone, the average person on the street, can beat the average guy or even what he said, what most people consider to be a good trader on Wall Street, certainly better than the stockbroker, he said. And he said that the average person can make those valuations. I know that also, since I think 42, 43, you moved down to the Bahamas, you're not part of that New York crowd. Has that played a role in your success, not being associated with those people directly, in your opinion? And can the average investor really learn to spot values on their own and then use a manager to make final decisions?
We have found that in the 31 years since we moved our world headquarters from New York City, where it had been for 25 years, to the Bahamas, where it's been the world headquarters until I sold it all a year ago, the performance was even better working from the Bahamas. And we think the reason is that it's easier to be unprejudiced, unbiased. If you do not invest where your headquarters are, you can see more clearly where in the world are the opportunities. Furthermore, you're less likely to be carried away by the crowd psychology. In New York, we went to the same meetings as the other security analysts, listened to the same corporation executives, and were somewhat influenced. Being away was easier to do things differently, and only if you do things differently can you have superior results. If you buy the same thing as the other analysts, you'll have the same results as the other analysts. You have to buy something different. Now, I disagree with Peter. Peter is a brilliant manager. I'd be delighted to invest with Peter, but I do not think the average person is likely to produce a superior result. I would go so far, although I can't prove it, is to say that I doubt if one investor in 10 has done as well as the index of the stock market over any long period of years. And the reason are that they are too much influenced by emotions. They tend to sell out when the business is bad. That's not the time to sell. That's the time to buy, and vice versa. Also, they tend to get carried away by the fashions in the market. They will buy whatever is on the front page of the newspaper or on the television. And there again, they have to pay high prices. It's already reflected in prices. So it pays to go against the fashion, not with the fashion. That's hard to do if you're not a professional with a lifetime of experience.
I tend to agree with you on that. I think the average investor, I'm sure the ratio you talked about is probably accurate or worse in terms of 1 in 10. Peter's approach is teaching people how to resist those very forces you're talking about. Whether they'll do it or not is a whole other thing, and if it's your profession, you have a better chance potentially. Let me ask you this. Your whole philosophy seems to me to be one of optimism over the last 53 years. Does optimism beat out pessimism in the world? Is optimism just being silly and stupid and positive, or is there a real understanding, a real principle there that affects not only investing but your whole life?
Two things again, Tony.
I love that. You always give two things. You always give added value, not just one. I'm impressed. Thank you.
We all tend to become what we think. If we think we can, we can. If we think we can't, we can't. And also, the same thing applies in all areas of life. If you start out with an attitude of optimism, you draw people to you. If you start out with an attitude of pessimism or complaint, you push people away. So there's a lot of truth in that. But in the stock market, I do not follow that rule. I do not try to be optimistic. In fact, I try very hard to be realistic. I try to look at things in their true situation. Now, that means, however, that I have normally spoken up in favor of buying common stocks, because few of us realize that we are living in the most glorious and progressive period of world history. Just in my lifetime, just in 81 years, the standard of living has quadrupled, not only in America, but worldwide. First time in history that ever happened. Often took 1,000 years to double the standard of living, but it's happened in one person's lifetime. Why? It's because half of the scientists who ever lived are alive today. It's because the world is spending $1 billion every day on scientific research. It's because now there's 600 schools, graduate schools of business management in America alone. When I was born, there were only two on Earth. All in medicine, the amount of knowledge we have is doubling more than every 15 years. The number of books published, over half of the world's books were published in the last 50 years, more published in every month now than were published in the whole world history up until the time of Christopher Columbus. The number of people going to college is 100 times as great as it was a century ago, on and on and on. So if you look at the fundamentals, particularly if you really track out the basic facts, we have been living through and will continue to live through the most rapidly progressive and prosperous period in the world history.
Well, maybe it's not optimism, maybe it's just realism, looking at the facts and not being so pessimistic so that you can see the reality.
Let me add something to that. The very nature of communications, you sell newspapers by putting something horrible on the front page. So you get people to turn on the television by having something shocking. So people get flooded with bad things, and they tend to think the world is bad. If you can get away from that influence and look at the basic facts, we should be overwhelmingly grateful every day to be living in the most glorious period of world history.
Tell me, what are you most grateful for in your life, Sir John?
I'm grateful for the helpfulness of all those millions of people who put down on paper the wisdom of the ages, so that I don't have to start to learn everything. I can learn from reading scriptures and histories and biographies of great people how to lead my own life.
What does leadership mean to you, and do we all have a responsibility to lead ourselves at least, or how would you describe leadership? How important will it be also in the 21st century, do you think?
Very important. Certainly when we are investing in a stock, we take a great interest in the leadership of that corporation. And everybody can be a leader in some sense of the word. They may not be the president of the corporation, but they can be the leader in terms of ethics for that corporation, or they can be the leader in terms of new products or new services, or they can be a leader in just doing their own job better than was ever done before for that particular job.
Tell me then, what is really the quality of a leader, of a great leader in your mind? And what are the qualities of a great investor? If you could address both those, I'd appreciate it.
You do ask big questions, Tony.
Yes, I do. I throw the ball and I know you'll hit a home run.
No. A great leader is the one who does not push, but leads. One who sets a good example. One who explains what he's trying to do and how a person can be more useful and more happy in their lives. That is a great leader. To be a great investor, I would focus on common sense. Don't be influenced by fashions. Don't think you know it all. Be willing to study hard and to make comparisons and to diversify in the long run.
Heard you say many times, and I think when we talked you said that making decisions out of fear is the wrong way to make a decision. Can you address what does fear do to human beings, and what's the antidote to fear? What do we really need as we move our lives into the next century?
Yes, fear is a great problem. To overcome fear, the best thing is to be overwhelmingly grateful. If you wake up each morning and think of 5 new things for which you're overwhelmingly grateful, you're not likely to be fearful, you're likely to radiate your optimism, your attitude of gratitude. You're likely to do things in a better way, draw more people to you. So I would think an attitude of gratitude will prevent a life of fear.
That's very great advice. We're extremely grateful for this time that we've had with you. I know you've touched everyone here who's listening, and this tape will go on to touch people for years to come. And I want to thank you for that time. And I know what an incredibly humble man you are. I've always, and I hate to use the word love because it sounds like something being used in an inappropriate way, but I love who you are as a human being. You're an example of the human spirit and what we're truly capable of. And I know you're humble, but I'm curious. How would you describe John Templeton? Who is this man? And or how would you like to be remembered? What is your legacy?
I'm a student, always trying to learn. I'm a sinner. All of us are. I try to be better day by day. And particularly, I try to keep asking myself, what are the purposes of God? Why did God create the universe? What does God expect of his children here? And the closest you can come in just a few words is he expects us to grow spiritually. He gives us trials and tribulations, just like you have examinations in school, because it may help you to grow into a greater soul than you would have otherwise. So life is a challenge. Life is an adventure. It's a marvelous, exciting adventure. All of us should do the very best we can as long as the Lord allows us to be on this planet.
I think the good Lord wants you to be here for quite some more time with all the people that you've touched. God bless you, and thank you so much for your time and for your wisdom. And I look forward to being with you personally again very soon, Sir John. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. The wisdom of an 81-year-old billionaire, one of the greatest investors of the last 50 years. Maybe the most important thing that we learned was that the same principles that would make you a great investor might also give you a great quality of life. I hope that this brief interview with this legend has created for you not only some new distinctions, some information that can make you more effective, maybe inspired you to raise your standards as a human being, to do more, to contribute more, and to grow more than ever before. Case, but I understand this last year, the results of that is the Emerging Market Fund brought back about a 97% return on the year, and I think the Emerging Growth Fund was 76%, is that correct? And what creates those kinds of returns?
Yes, the organization, before I sold it, was the first in the world to offer to the public mutual fund shares that would invest in the emerging markets, those small nations which had always been considered too risky for us to invest in before. And that was 6 years ago, and the performance has been truly outstanding. So from the original $100 million, other funds have been formed, managed by that organization, about $12 billion in these foreign emerging markets. And many other competitors, more than a dozen now, have similar funds, so that the Americans in general are investing something like $15 billion in the poor, small, emerging markets where it's difficult to get information, but where the potential is sometimes very great.
Why should we feel good about the investments that we do overseas as Americans? Some people would say, why invest overseas? It seems like that's taking away from America. You were one of the first people to go into emerging markets. You were one of the first people to go overseas and be an international investor. Why should investors want to go outside their own country to make investments today?
Yes, it has always seemed to be just common sense, Tony. Think about this. If our job is to find the best opportunities, surely we will find more opportunities if we do not limit ourselves to just any one nation. Likewise, perhaps we will find better opportunities if we are able to look everywhere rather than just one nation. But most important is it does reduce your risk, because every nation has bear markets. Usually about twice every 12 years, there's a severe bear market in a major nation, but they do not occur at the same time. So if you are diversified, having your assets in many nations, you do not have to suffer through the bear market in one nation as a person who had all of his eggs in one basket. So for those three reasons, we have always advised our investors to be diversified, not only diversified into more than one corporation, diversified in more than one industry, but also diversified into more than one nation, in order that they will get greater safety and greater potential profit.
Fantastic. Let me ask you this. Also, I know you focus quite a bit on improving the quality of life. When we make investments in those types of nations, does it really affect the quality of life for us here back in the United States, do you think?
Yes, it does in both cases. The money that is earned by investing in those small nations means the dividends and interest come back to the United States for the investor. But at the same time, we help those nations to grow in prosperity, and they become customers for the exports from the United States. So they help the United States to be more prosperous by exporting more, in addition to which we get spiritual rewards for helping the people who were previously pitifully poor to catch up somewhat with the remarkable prosperity in America.
One of the things that I've always respected and loved about you as a human being is that many people, when they think about money or wealth, they think about something that is cutthroat. They think about something that doesn't take into account the human spirit. How do you resolve the break that so many people have between spirituality, if I may ask you, and finance? Do they go together?
Definitely. There is no disparity. There is no conflict. Again, using just common sense, would you want to deal with a businessman you could not trust? No. If a man has a reputation for not being trustworthy, people will run away from him. His business will fail. But if another man has high ethical principles, high spiritual principles, he will try to give to his customers and his employees more than they expect. If so, he will be popular. He will have more customers. He will make more profit. He will do more good in the world, and thereby he will prosper himself and have more friends and be more respected. So always start out to give more than you get, to give more than is expected from you, to treat the other person more than fairly, and that is the secret of success. Never try to take advantage of anyone or to hold anyone back in their own progress. The more you help others, the more prosperous you'll be personally.
What is your definition of wealth, Sir John?
Well, the Bible says to store up your treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, nor thieves break through, nor steal. And if I had to choose one investment, Tony, the one that I've never seen to fail, it is tithing, T-I-T-H-I-N-G, giving 10% or more of your income to churches and charities. I have never met or watched anyone who did tithing for 10 years who did not become both prosperous and happy. The qualities it takes to be a good tither are the same qualities it takes to be a good businessman, to be popular, to be sought after by your customers.
Let me ask you, Sir John, over the last period of time, as you've done all this tithing, I know you helped start the college at Oxford. I know you give, again, $1 million a year away, which is higher than the Nobel Prize for people who really produce or promote spiritual principles. What do you think is the first road for someone being able to do that? So many people say, well, I'll tithe once I have some money. Why shouldn't someone wait? Why should they start now, even if they're in financial trouble with tithing?
Oh, they should. It's only an excuse to say that I will begin once I have more money. If I can put that in dramatic terms, Americans now save very little. They only save about 4 cents out of every dollar they earn because they say they can't save more. But in mainland China, where the national income is less than 1/20 of American income, those people save more than 1/3 of their total income. So it doesn't matter whether your income is small or large, you can be a tither and you can be a saver.
And you must be a saver to really become wealthy, because otherwise you have nothing to invest with. Let me ask you this, sir. What you believe has been the most important principle that has separated you from all the rest? What has made you, and I know you might not call yourself this, but the greatest investor of all time, or at least one of them? What do you think has separated you from the group?
Thank you. I do not regard myself as that.
I know you're very humble.
I just studying and working. I've been working nights and days and weekends trying to learn more in order to help the hundreds of thousands of people who invested in the Templeton Mutual Funds. We've not always been right. No one is. But we have tried to be a little better than the other competitors and to give more than is expected from us, and always to try to improve our methods, to use new methods in order to stay ahead of the competition. If there's any secret in it at all, it is this. Do not try to be a go-getter. Try to be a go-giver.
Very good. Your giving philosophy certainly has worked for billions of dollars for hundreds of thousands or millions of people. Let me ask you this. As you look at investing then, what would you say is the single biggest mistake that investors make? And what do you think is the single most important thing for them to do to avoid that mistake and become successful as investors?
Perhaps the greatest mistake is not to be thrifty. The great majority of people do not build up any wealth because they do not practice the self-discipline of saving some of their income every month to build up their wealth. But beyond that, once you've saved that money, then you have to invest it wisely in good bargains, and it's not easy. It's very, very rare for any one person, particularly any one person working in just their spare time, to select the right investments. Any more than you would want to be your own medical doctor or your own lawyer, it's not wise to try to be your own investment manager. It's better to find the best professionals, the wisest security analysts, to help you. You can do that by hiring an investment counselor if you have enough assets, or if you have smaller assets, then to invest in those public investment mutual funds who then hire for you some good investment counselor in order to produce the better results in the long run.
I know that you teach, though, it sounds as if you would say give your money to a manager, which I think is accurate, but I think you also teach you've got to be responsible for your own money. You don't, just like a doctor, you want to just take one opinion and hope it's right. How do you balance that out? How do we take responsibility for how we're investing our wealth rather than just hoping that the person we've selected will do a good job?
As you said, it is very much like selecting a doctor or selecting a lawyer. You do need to study the person, his background, his history, his methods, and the organization that he has built. Talk with some of his customers, just as you would with a lawyer or a doctor. But in the field of investments, you do have one more advantage, is that every mutual fund is required by law to publish the results it has had in the past years. So you can very easily get a comparison of which mutual funds were most profitable in the past. And although that doesn't guarantee they will be the best in the future, it at least is one more help you have that you do not have when selecting professionals in other careers.
That makes sense. Let me ask you this. You talk constantly about the long term. Will you please address this for our students and the people listening in? What is the importance of long-term versus short-term investing? What is the difference between long-term and short-term investing as far as you're concerned?
The short-term prices are determined very heavily by human emotions, and that can go up or down unexpectedly. But in the long run, the price of the shares of a corporation will depend on the earnings of that corporation, so that value will prove to be the controlling influence in the long run. Or, to put it in a different way, all economic matters, especially the stock market, goes in cycles. There are bull markets and bear markets, and you never know when they're going to start or stop. But if you're a true long-term investor, you don't need to worry about that. You buy and hold the assets through two or three bull and bear markets, through two or three cycles. So the underlying strength, the underlying earning power will determine your profits.
So how long? I'm sorry.
Well, for example, we think there will be probably as many as six or seven bear markets in the next 40 years. But we also think that earning power of corporations may rise by fourfold in 40 years in today's dollars. Then, of course, we think the dollar will lose in value. So in terms of future dollars, the earnings will be even greater than that. So if you look long range, you're a true investor, not a speculator. It's easier to find the true bargains and take less risk.
I know, talking to some of your associates when I was down in the Bahamas at one point, I said, what does he invest in? What is his favorite thing to invest in? And they said, anything, anything. He'll buy a tree if he knows. He'll buy anything that he knows is undervalued. And I said, how long will he hang on to it? And they said, forever. They said, he'll hang on to it until it's worth more. Can you explain that? Will you really, how long will you hang on to an investment?
Well, Tony, this is a basic principle that applies in all of your activities. And that is that good fortune tends to come to the person who is prepared ahead of time. If you do hard work, study, common sense, mathematical comparisons, then when a bargain comes along, you will recognize it to be a bargain. Let me give you two quick illustrations that are way out of line with the investment world. But one day I was reading a little two-line advertisement in the New York Times that said, 500 acres of land for sale on paved highway within 100 miles of New York City, $17 an acre. I called up on the telephone and bought it that night on the telephone because I already knew enough about values to know that was exceptional and wouldn't last. It turned out to be Little Buck Mountain in Pennsylvania near Nuremberg, and my children still own that mountain. But one more quick one. When I was traveling in Rio de Janeiro, I went to see a jeweler who was offering my wife amethyst rings. And I said to him, what do these amethysts look like when you buy them from the discoverers, the explorers from the field? So he took me to his warehouse and showed me a room covered 2 feet deep with big crystals of amethyst. I said to him again, in this stage, what do these cost? He said, $2 a pound. So I bought 2,000 pounds of amethyst.
But the secret to investing right there from Sir John.
To be prepared.
Be prepared. How long will you hang on to an investment before you let it go? How do you know when you've made a mistake? How do you know when it's time to liquidate?
That is one of the most important questions. Many people will say, I know when to buy, but I don't know when to sell. But over these 54 years that I've been helping investors, I think I have the answer. That is, you sell an asset only when you think you have found a different asset that's a 50% better bargain. you search all the time for a bargain, and then you look at what you now own. If it's something in your present list that is 50% less good bargain than the one you've found, you sell the old one and buy the new one. But even then, you're not right all the time.
That's true. How do you deal with the emotion of taking losses? I mean, certainly, you're such a responsible human being. I know you don't take anything lightly, especially other people's fortunes that you're managing. How do you deal with the emotion of that? What's your belief system about dealing with losses?
But in those years, those 53 years when I was truly active in investment counsel, before I retired and began to devote almost 100% of my time to church and charity work, in those years, I went to explain to every client that they must not expect us to be correct in our decisions more than two-thirds of the time. The difficulty is so great that if we just made one mistake out of three decisions, the total result would be good. So we kept a record for years and years of what we bought and sold, and we showed when we were right, when we were wrong, but we also showed the long-term good result, which you already mentioned earlier in this program, and that showed them that they did not need to be upset, and we did not need to be upset, because we do make so many mistakes, because if we work hard, we will make more right decisions than wrong ones.
How do you think that relates to people's daily lives outside of finance?
Oh, very much so. I was asked on a television program recently why we do not form an investment mutual fund to invest just in every stock, in the stocks in the index, because that way we would always have an equal share of all the big companies. But I said to him, it's true that when we go to sell one stock and buy another, we're not right all the time. And if you look at everybody in the world, there's exactly as many people wrong as right. But that same thing would be true about the game of tennis. If throughout the history of that game, there have been exactly as many winners and losers, but that's no reason for the good tennis players to stop playing.
Touché. Very nice. Tell us about your very first decision to invest, if you would. What's the 53 years? How old are you, may I ask? I thought you were 80 years old.
I'm 81 years old, Tony. Almost middle age, I think.
Yes, I think you're right. And you certainly act less than middle age. What was your very first investment, I guess, 53 years ago? What made you decide to invest in that, and how did it turn out?
The first investment I bought was the preferred stock of Standard Gas and Electric, but I think it'll carry the message better. Is when I was just getting started, was the beginning of the Second World War in September 1939. Now, we had just finished the world's greatest depression, and there were many bankrupt companies, but a war causes a demand for almost every product. So during a war, almost every company will prosper again. So I gave a stockbroker an order to buy $100 worth of every stock on both exchanges, selling for $1 or less. And there were 104 of them. And out of those, I made a profit on 100, lost money on only 4, and here was the best of all. One of those stocks was a $7 preferred stock of Missouri Pacific Railway, sold in the 1920s, paying $7 cash per year, but the railway went into bankruptcy, and that preferred stock could be bought for 12 cents. So for my $100, I got 800 shares of that preferred stock. Then the war put the traffic on the railway and it began to prosper again. And that stock went up from 12 cents to $5. I thought I was so smart and sold out. And yet when 2 years later, it went up to 107.
Did you find a stock that you thought was a 50% better deal than the railway before you let go of that stock? Or did you just try to cash in?
No, I followed the principle back then. They were at that time better bargains, yes.
Fantastic. Well, then it sounds like you did the right thing. Tell me, I remember when we sat together about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe it was longer, I've lost track of time, you know how it is at my age. But I do recall at the time I asked you, where in the world is the bargain right now? Where are you investing? And you said Hong Kong. And I said, Hong Kong? Everybody was fleeing from Hong Kong because they said, you know, China's going to take it over, the market's going to disappear. And you just smiled real big and said, yeah, but there's some great bargains there. There's some things they're going to need no matter what. Even if they do take over, there's some companies they're going to need. Tell us about that. Tell us two things. How do you find that bargain? Where do you look? And where in the world would you find it today, in your opinion?
Now, that's a very basic principle, Tony. You find the bargains at the point of maximum pessimism. From a time standpoint, you find it when people in general are pessimistic. That's the low point of the market. But if you're looking at a nation, you find it in the nation where there's great pessimism, or the industry where there's great pessimism. So there's nothing that will make the price of a share go down except the pressure of selling. So you can only get a bargain when other people are urgently selling. Now, in Hong Kong, they were selling because they were frightened to become part of a communist nation. But thereby, the share prices were so depressed that we were buying them at bargain prices, thinking that even after it becomes part of a former communist nation, it would still be the financial center, maybe the commercial center for over a billion people. So we did buy heavily in Hong Kong, and even just last year alone, the Hong Kong market went up over 100%. Now it's no longer a bargain. Now there are too many other people buying there, and it's not a point of maximum pessimism. But to complete the answer to that, where in the world are they today? In the world today, there are several markets that went up 100% last year when the American market was only going up 10%. Those were Hong Kong and Indonesia and Sri Lanka and Brazil and Finland and Turkey. All of those went up more than 100% in 1 year. But on the other hand, there are many markets now that are still depressed, where people are still despondent, where share prices are 50% or more below their previous high. And they would be Greece and New Zealand and Turkey and Portugal. All of those are more than 50% down from their highs. So to finish your question, you buy at the point of maximum pessimism, and then you wait patiently until that pessimism is gone and the share price has gone up. Then you try to find a different place of maximum pessimism.
And if I can complete the answers, I think I've heard you share it with me before. You also sell, hopefully, at the high of optimism. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's a good saying there, Tony. Bear markets start on the time of pessimism. They rise on the time of skepticism. They mature on the time of optimism. And they end on the time of euphoria. That always happens in every bull market, and it helps you determine where you are. If you will just talk with enough investors to find their psychology, you can tell whether the market is still safe at a low level or high at a dangerous level.
Sir John, in the markets you described that went more than 100% last year, how does a person determine whether that there is still growth left in that market, whether there are still bargains or not?
Just as you said before, you do it by valuation. You take appraisals, just like a real estate appraiser would appraise a hotel. He would study the number of rooms, the price, what other hotels sold for, the profits, and so forth, and come out with a reasonable estimate of the value of that hotel. So does a security analyst appraise a corporation. So we appraise the corporations and then compare the market prices to the estimated value. Now, it's true that a market can easily go up 100% and still be a good value. And whether it is or not depends on comparing the price with the value.
That makes sense. Peter Lynch, who we have a chance to visit with here at Master University as well, is an amazing trader. And one of his philosophies is he tells me that He believes that anyone, the average person on the street, can beat the average guy or even what he said, what most people consider to be a good trader on Wall Street, certainly better than the stockbroker, he said. And he said that the average person can make those valuations. I know that also, you know, since I think 42, 43, you moved down to the Bahamas, you're not part of that New York crowd. Has that played a role in your success, not being associated with those people directly, in your opinion? And can the average investor really learn to spot values on their own and then use a manager to make final decisions?
We have found that in the 31 years since we moved our world headquarters from New York City, where it had been for 25 years, to the Bahamas, where we'd been the world headquarters until I sold it all a year ago, the performance was even better working from the Bahamas. And we think the reason is that it's easier to be unprejudiced, unbiased. If you do not invest where your headquarters are, you can see more clearly where in the world are the opportunities. Furthermore, you're less likely to be carried away by the crowd psychology. In New York, we went to the same meetings as the other security analysts, listened to the same corporation executives, and were somewhat influenced. Being away was easier to do things differently, and only if you do things differently can you have superior results. If you buy the same thing as the other analysts, you'll have the same results as the other analysts. You have to buy something different. Now, I disagree with Peter. Peter is a brilliant manager. I'd be delighted to invest with Peter, but I do not think the average person is likely to produce a superior result. I would go so far, although I can't prove it, is to say that I doubt if one investor in 10 has done as well as the index of the stock market over any long period of years. And the reasons are that they are too much influenced by emotions. They tend to sell out when the business is bad. That's not the time to sell. That's the time to buy, and vice versa. Also, they tend to get carried away by the fashions in the market. They will buy whatever is on the front page of the newspaper or on the television. And there again, they have to pay high prices. It's already reflected in prices. So it pays to go against the fashion, not with the fashion. That's hard to do if you're not a professional with a lifetime of experience.
I tend to agree with you on that. I think the average investor, I'm sure the ratio you talked about is probably accurate or worse in terms of 1 in 10. Peter's approach is teaching people how to resist those very forces you're talking about. Whether they'll do it or not is a whole other thing, and if it's your profession, you have a better chance potentially. Let me ask you this. Your whole philosophy seems to me to be one of optimism over the last 53 years. Does optimism beat out pessimism in the world? Is optimism just being silly and stupid and positive, or is there a real understanding, a real principle there that affects not only investing but your whole life?
Two things again, Tony.
I love that. I love that. You always give two things. You always give added value, not just one. I'm impressed. Thank you.
We all tend to become what we think. If we think we can, we can. If we think we can't, we can't. And also, the same thing applies in all areas of life. If you start out with an attitude of optimism, you draw people to you. If you start out with an attitude of pessimism or complaint, you push people away. So there's a lot of truth in that. But in the stock market, I do not follow that rule. I do not try to be optimistic. In fact, I try very hard to be realistic. I try to look at things in their true situation. Now, that means, however, that I have normally spoken up in favor of buying common stocks because few of us realize that we are living in the most glorious and progressive period of world history. Just in my lifetime, just in 81 years, the standard of living has quadrupled, not only in America, but worldwide. First time in history that ever happened. Often took 1,000 years to double the standard of living, but it's happened in one person's lifetime. Why? It's because half of the scientists who ever lived are alive today. It's because the world is spending $1 billion every day on scientific research. It's because now there's 600 schools, graduate schools of business management in America alone. When I was born, there were only two on earth. All in medicine, the amount of knowledge we have is doubling more than every 15 years. The number of books published, over half of the world's books were published in the last 50 years. More published in every month now than were published in whole world history up until the time of Christopher Columbus. The number of people going to college is 100 times as great as it was a century ago. On and on and on. So if you look at the fundamentals, particularly if you really track out the basic facts, we have been living through and will continue to live through the most rapidly progressive and prosperous period in the world history.
Well, maybe it's not optimism. Maybe it's just realism looking at the facts and not being so pessimistic so that you can see the reality.
Let me add something to that. The very nature of communications. You sell newspapers by putting something horrible on the front page. So you get people to turn on the television by having something shocking. So people get flooded with bad things and they tend to think the world is bad. If you can get away from that influence and look at the basic facts, we should be overwhelmingly grateful every day to be living in the most glorious period of world history.
Tell me, what are you most grateful for in your life, Sir John?
I'm grateful for the helpfulness of all those millions of people who put down on paper the wisdom of the ages so that I don't have to start to learn everything. I can learn from reading scriptures and histories and biographies of great people how to lead my own life.
What does leadership mean to you? And do we all have a responsibility to lead ourselves at least? Or how would you describe leadership? How important will it be also in the 21st century, do you think?
Very important. Certainly when we are investing in a stock, we take a great interest in the leadership of that corporation. And everybody can be a leader in some sense of the word. They may not be the president of the corporation, but they can be the leader in terms of ethics for that corporation, or they can be the leader in terms of new products or new services, or they can be a leader in just doing their own job better than was ever done before for that particular job.
Tell me then, what is really the quality of a leader, of a great leader in your mind, and what are the qualities of a great investor? If you could address both those, I'd appreciate it.
You do ask big questions, Tony.
Yes, I do. I throw the ball and I know you'll hit a home run.
No. A great leader is the one who does not push but leads. One who sets a good example. One who explains what he's trying to do and how a person can be more useful and more happy in their lives. That is a great leader. To be a great investor, I would focus on common sense. Don't be influenced by fashions. Don't think you know it all. Be willing to study hard and to make comparisons and to diversify in the long run.
I've heard you say many times, and I think when we talked, you said that making decisions out of fear is the wrong way to make a decision. Can you address what does fear do to human beings, and what's the antidote to fear? What do we really need as we move our lives into the next century?
Yes, fear is a great problem. To overcome fear, the best thing is to be overwhelmingly grateful. If you wake up each morning and think of five new things for which you're overwhelmingly grateful, you're not likely to be fearful. You're likely to radiate your optimism, your attitude of gratitude. You're likely to do things in a better way, draw more people to you. So I would think an attitude of gratitude will prevent a life of fear.
That's very great advice. We're extremely grateful for this time that we've had with you. I know you've touched everyone here who's listening, and this tape will go on to touch people for years to come. I want to thank you for that time. And I know what an incredibly humble man you are. I've always, I hate to use the word love because it sounds like something being used in an inappropriate way, but I love who you are as a human being. You're an example of the human spirit and what we're truly capable of. And I know you're humble, but I'm curious. How would you describe John Templeton? Who is this man? And or how would you like to be remembered? What is your legacy?
I'm a student, always trying to learn. I'm a sinner. All of us are. I try to be better day by day. And particularly, I try to keep asking myself, what are the purposes of God? Why did God create the universe? What does God expect of his children here? And the closest you can come in just a few words is he expects us to grow spiritually. He gives us trials and tribulations, just like you have examinations in school, because it may help you to grow into a greater soul than you would have otherwise. So life is a challenge. Life is an adventure. It's a marvelous, exciting adventure. All of us should do the very best we can as long as the Lord allows us to be on this planet.
I think the good Lord wants you to be here for quite some more time with all the people that you've touched. God bless you, and thank you so much for your time and for your wisdom. And I look forward to being with you personally again very soon, Sir John. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. The wisdom of an 81-year-old billionaire, one of the greatest investors of the last 50 years. Maybe the most important thing that we learned was that the same principles that would make you a great investor might also give you a great quality of life. I hope that this brief interview with this legend has created for you not only some new distinctions, some information that can make you more effective, maybe inspired you to raise your standards as a human being, to do more, to contribute more, and to grow more than ever before.